Welcome to the Stinging Fly podcast. My name is Nicole Flattery. The Stinging Fly has been publishing new writers and new writing for the past 28 years. We take a particular interest in promoting the short story, and for this podcast, we ask writers from the latest issue of the Stinging Fly to join us in the studio and discuss their work. On this month's episode, I'm joined by writer Ella Gaynor. Ella's essay, What About Rain, was recently published in the Stinging Fly issue 53, The Climate Issue, which has a special focus on the climate crisis. Ella's writing has been published in The Stinging Fly, The Pig's Back, and The Dublin Review. She has served tables in Galway, Dublin, Amsterdam, and Vienna. She writes weekly about her work on her Substack, Trishik. Hi, Ella.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. Well, I am so sick. Would you like to read a little bit from
your essay? I am going to read from the essay, somewhere nicely in the middle. We go between Galway and Naples and a little bit of Dublin. So I'm going to go to Naples.
Yeah, perfect.
I had always prided myself on being able to navigate a new city. But here I stumbled dumbly, dodging mopeds whizzing inches from our toes, sometimes with four young boys to a seat, suffering voices which called at us, eyes which stared at us in our embarrassingly big backpacks. We eventually found our sublet and signed the contract in a daze. The apartment had its own strong odour of drains and damp. It was on the ground floor of a tall, narrow building with a tiled floor and white plastered walls, some sections showing exposed stone, which must have been the original building material. The bathroom had the strongest smell, and the floor was alive with slithering silverfish and other long antennaed creatures. There was a loft bed above our kitchen, wide wooden stairs leading up to it from the front door. The windows were barred. We figured out we live next door to a laundrette. All day we heard the calls of the workers as load after load of sheets was delivered by moped from across the city. Intermittently throughout the day, as the machines drained next door, we heard water whoosh through the pipes in the low ceiling, the thunderous charge of liquid sounding like it might burst through the curved roof above our bed. We took strolls to get our bearings. Every side street seemed to have been used as a toilet, and we jogged past corners of steaming excrement. We began to know these corners by the sound of flies humming as we approached. If we stopped to buy an apple, it was put in one plastic bag, then another. At the harbour were man-made rock mounds where land had been reclaimed for road, just like in Salt Hill. And between these mounds were worlds of plastic. Petrol jerry cans, faded boys, lengths of corded turquoise rope. There were beer cans, their brands worn off by the slow lap of the tideless Mediterranean Sea. We clambered over the rock walls, dodging more humming shit piles to sit near the gentle waves, and to our left we realised we could see Mount Vesuvius. Awed, we craned our necks over a wall of docked cruise ships, each the size of a small airport, with a festival frenzy of multicoloured lights exploding from every level, music pumping from unseen speakers, what looked like carnival rides on the top decks. One day we boarded the train towards Vesuvius. Out here, the sand was black, volcanic. We picked our way around the train track, following the sound of music and voices, the smell of smoke, to find a swimming cove where elderly locals had gathered, each tanned to the colour of rust, each with a green beer bottle glinting in hand. The winter sun set quickly and a glorious golden light cast momentary calm. The leathery locals packed up their party. The black sand turned honey-hued, glass shards from long smashed bottles glitter glinting as the rays slid across the beach. Abruptly, men with cameras materialised as if hatched from the sand. All at once, hetero couples in formal wear were being professionally photographed on this wall or that, looking this way or the other. A child in a white communion gown was placed in the shallows and posed obediently. Even now, the image of her photograph printed on canvas and mounted above some unknown mantelpiece arrives in my head with surprising regularity. My boyfriend had made salami and cheese sandwiches and we split the final one. As we chewed, we were suddenly surrounded by noxious pink smoke, thick and petrol fumed, against which our fanning hands were useless. a couple ran up and down the beach, holding aloft a flare for what appeared to be a gender reveal. A cinematographer crouched jogging behind them with an enormous film camera.
Thank you, Ella. That was great. So, do you want to talk to me about writing this essay?
Yes. So, I saw the Singing Fly were open for pitch submissions, and I sent a pitch, which was originally about overflowing bins. I was very obsessed with overflowing bins. I was living in Amsterdam at the time, and the bins were always pulled open and spilling out, and I just... Bins are always full. Yeah. So that was my original pitch.
It's like where I live as well in Stony Batter, there's always,
The bins are, the bins are flooding. And
why can't they get bigger bins?
Yes, I know, why can't, or more, but that's always been an issue everywhere I've lived, more bins. It was originally about bins, and I think my first draft was about bins. I was working with Roisin, and we went back and forth a lot, and it morphed a lot with the conversation. I think it was maybe too subtly linked to climate and climate crisis, and given that that was what the issue was revolving around, Roisin was very gently suggesting maybe I could focus more directly on it. I think I thought bins was enough.
It's often enough.
And it ended up, I don't know how, it wasn't about this, because I lived in Galway for so long, and there was always flood risks and rain, and it consumed so much of my waking hours living there.
Yeah,
it just very naturally became about that instead.
I think if you live in Galway, and I can say this as someone who's up there, you become obsessed with the weather. Like, obsessed.
Yes.
Like, I don't think I've ever been as... And I'm obsessed with the weather generally.
Yes, but we all are.
But when I lived in Galway, you were just constantly on that little, like, phone thing, being like, when's it going to rain? When's
it
going to rain?
I could feel it in my, in my, the fear in my gut. And, like, I had just never seen weather like that here when I was growing up in Dublin. And I remember the first year I moved, there was days... I would have missed college anyway, but there was days where I said, I can't go today because the rain is too hard and I can't. I have an umbrella that is not an umbrella when you put it up anymore. So
I think it's everyone talks about the weather down there as well. Like, it's a constant source of conversation. Not in the way it is in Dublin.
Because it affects, if it affected us here in the same way, I think we would talk about it more. Whereas there, it really feels like... life or death or house or no house kind of thing. More so in like Cork and other places that are more clear.
Yeah.
But you... This is being really battered.
I think, you know, you mentioned it in the essay, those kind of like striking images that we always get from like storms in Galway and things, which is cars like floating, and always cars floating in like that salt
cars
car.
Floating, or people going into the cinema and coming out and their car is gone.
Or someone jumping off the diving board during a storm and having to be rescued.
Always.
So it does feel like the climate is like, it's very intense in the west of Ireland, which like does inform your work, you know? I'm sure like Kevin Barry would say that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you can't ignore it. You're very aware. I think they put up pictures a few years ago in Galway where people had kind of edited pictures of like you walking down Shop Street and someone has like a fishbowl on their head. Galway in the future, and people are like rowing on mounds of trash and all that kind of stuff, and it seems quite real. And you see versions of that happen like a good few times a year when you're there.
My favorite thing about Galway in the wet is like you will see, you know, tourists like decked out in the full, you know, rain gear, rain jacket, like everything, like looking so warm and stuff. And then you'll just see guys that are so used to it in like a shirt. It's like, and they don't even feel the rain anymore.
And shorts. Yeah. I support shorts in the rain because I would rather have wet legs than wet jeans.
Yeah, I see your point.
It's, they get a lot of flack for wearing their shorts in the rain and the snow. And I think you can dust off your legs.
Did you think your time in Galway, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about that because I know you went to university in Galway. Did it make you think more intensely about the climate crisis. Like you said, there's a moment where you and your mother are watching a documentary and like certain other things bring it to mind. But it is like a daily kind of thing in Galway. And you're even talking about the sandbags and looking at the river where it's like all protected. And yeah, I think it feels more like a real thing that's happening down there than I feel up here.
Definitely. Yeah. I'm from Sandyford in Dublin, which is quite high up.
Yeah.
Apparently. I looked it up during my climate nerves. But yes, I was actively engaging with sandbags and working in a restaurant where we would move all the furniture upstairs. If there was a flood warning, like just wading through water, you do just become more aware of it because it feels stronger.
Mm-hmm.
The town feels smaller. You feel more vulnerable to it. Like there was that video of a truck getting blown over near Mam's Cross. Like these, you do see the realities of harsh wind, harsh rain. And it does feel quite, I don't like to be pessimistic, but it does feel quite inevitable. Like it's, like it does feel like you're sinking and the water is rising, but it does feel like it's impossible to stop.
But then you have the opposite side of this, which is like a complete like blinkers on, because at the same time, it's becoming more alert to climate change. Galway is becoming so like over tourism, like constantly. So it's just getting busier and busier. But at the same time, you know,
it's not stopping. I think I mentioned it in the essay, there's cruise ships coming into Galway and they don't fit in the port. So they park just out in the bay between Galway and Clare and they look monstrous. Mm. And I was working in a cafe in Salt Hill and all anybody could talk about, did you see the... Yeah. And it's kind of crazy because even a few years ago during COVID, you were seeing like dolphins or maybe people see whales out there and it's more like, did you see the big cruise ship? That's kind of the way we're gone.
Yeah.
Rather than like we don't see, I would see so many animals during COVID in Galway, like amazing otters in the, and we're just so detached from it.
Yeah.
And there's like hotels going up everywhere and
It is even, it's grim. It's crazy in the summer, you know?
Yeah. I remember one day it just felt like the floodgates opened and it never stopped with travel. Mm. And it's that thing of, well, we need it to survive, but we're kind of digging ourselves into the ground with it a little bit.
And the process of writing this essay, when you were writing it, did you find it like grim subject matter? Like when you were digging into it, did you feel, God, this isn't going to get better? You mentioned like Kim Kardashian taking her private jet to go shopping, or Elon Musk doing whatever he's doing. And like, you know, we have no control that, like, you know, you have that refrain of washing out the yogurt cartons, but it's like so minor. It's so pointless in the face of all of this stuff. You know?
That's the, I do quite feel that way because just the world we live in and the world you see people live in on your phones, not everyone is in Galway or even like on the Aran Islands.
Yeah.
Those are the smaller the places and the more natural it is, the more affected they are. And then you have these insane people spending and like consuming.
Yeah.
There's Nandini's story in this issue I found really good with the tulips and the expensive wedding and the real, she's talking about the heat and the heat going. I find that really hits the mark in terms of what the problem is. When like wealthy people consuming and producing the way they do is just, well, it's corporations more than people.
Yeah.
And you do feel like an idiot bringing your keep cup in for a coffee.
Particularly,
but you feel torn between what you can do. So I won't bother doing it because I won't make a difference. But then, what do we do? It does feel inevitable, like it disaster does. Is and around then, the corner.
It, like if you look at something like data centers and things as well, like, you know, they're going up everywhere and they waste so much energy and water and like drive the price of electricity up. It just seems so incredibly wasteful, you know, for like a technology that nobody wants.
Yeah. And that is always wrong.
Yeah, I was wrong. Yeah. I'm sick and it was diagnosing me with...
You don't... Yeah. Yes, I was kind of... It did strike me when writing this essay because I was very much focused on myself more than the climate, which I think is what Roisin was trying to remind me to keep looking at the climate. Yeah. And even just talking about my years living in Galway made me realize how much had changed in that short space of time. And that was just me witnessing a very small corner of the effect in real time.
Mm.
I really did see that.
Yeah.
In a way I hadn't appreciated.
Ella, you're from, you know, a generation. You're 28. 28. I was trying to make you 29.
Almost.
Which I feel you've been raised with like a more, certainly even more than me, like a consciousness of the climate crisis, be an awareness of it. Like you talk about like even working in a pizza place in Galway and like Greta Thunberg. And I feel like it's cast such a shadow over your lives, even in a way that it didn't even in mine. All the things that I learned about the climate when we were young seem so like minor and almost cutesy. Like we do things like green skulls and...
Yes, we did that too. Yeah. It and feels like...
Yeah, recycling projects and things.
Yes.
But it wasn't like, you know, the world is going to overheat and you will be battling for food. We didn't have that kind of conversation.
I don't think we did either. I think we had a green schools committee... Like learning when to flush.
You know?
That was the extent of it.
You get an hour off here, there.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. And I remember, I don't remember what year it was, but I remember when my mum said, okay, now we're going to recycle. And I think it was probably because they brought in out separate bins. Maybe the bins hadn't been. And I remember like learning to do that.
Yeah.
So I think it probably was life in Galway because I think in school it was the same thing. You learn about greenhouse gases.
The ozone layer.
The ozone layer had a hole. And then seeing that documentary that I referenced about Ireland 2050, that terrified me because my mum was like, I won't be there, which not worth thinking about. And B, it's very soon.
It's much sooner than you think.
It's very soon.
Yeah.
And then just, that access to so much information of, you see, like at the same time we live without thinking about these things, but we have access to see all these issues happening, but we kind of choose not to.
Mm.
I don't know if it's access to social media information that makes it feel worse.
Yeah.
And or can very add to your sense of panic. Yeah. Because you see Kim Kardashian shopping and fashion houses like burning things so that they keep their value. They like burn big piles of unsold so that it's still valuable and not out flooded the market. It's crazy.
It is. I think fashion is something in the last like few years that has really come under like a microscope about like how wasteful they are. And
I remember I studied economics as well, very randomly in Galway.
I knew that.
And it was the best. It was like the least offensive of my options, surprisingly. But I remember studying the fashion like houses and all of their pledges. Essentially said by 2040, we will think about stopping burning. You know, no one is planning or enacting real climate change.
No, they're
now.
Not. No,
no,
definitely
no.
Not.
It's all just promises and projections. And
at the same time then, like clothes are getting much, much worse. Like what they're being made with is getting much worse and it's going to go to a landfill sooner. And it doesn't feel like in that way that there has been any improvement or any, like if you want to shop ethically, it's like extremely difficult.
It's really difficult and it's expensive
as well for
people to go and source.
And time consuming.
All these things kind of go hand in hand. Mm. Like after COVID, we all just got used to buying things on our phones more and seeing things on our phones more. And you really have to go out of your way to, I feel like an antiquated person if I'm like, I'm going to go to a hardware store to buy a specific item and pay more for it than I would on my phone and travel for 45 minutes with public transport to get to this store and they'll order it in for me and it'll be here in 3 weeks. You know, it's...
I love being an antiquated person. Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to the cobbler.
Yes,
you're going to the hardware store.
And we're running out of cobblers. We're running out of all these things. Yeah, you do feel cool, but you also feel niche and privileged and
you do.
Like you can afford to go and
see your cobbler.
Pay extra so that you're not buying a kettle on Amazon, you know?
Ella, I want to talk to you amidst all that grim subject matter about your own work. So tell me how you started writing.
I always wrote, I think. I had visions of being the youngest published author ever. And I remember seeing something in the newspaper, maybe about a 12-year-old with a book out. And I just thought, well, no point trying now. That's over.
Yeah.
I did have an idea that I think was The Hunger Games before The Hunger Games. And then The Hunger Games came out and I thought, oh, well, you know. I was beaten to the post a few times. They must have read my diary because I had it all planned out. But I've always loved writing and reading. I was always... distracted and late for things or like I would just sit in the bathroom as a child because I'm thinking about things for long and people would come looking for me. And so that's all I wanted to do in university.
Mm.
And if I didn't do that, I didn't want to go. Yeah. So I went to Galway and did, I think it was arts with creative writing, kind of disgusted that I couldn't just do creative writing. I think it wasn't available on this island at the time.
Can you,
as a sole
I don't know if you can do
undergrad.
It as an undergrad anywhere.
Maybe in Belfast. I think there was kind of Belfast, UCD or Galway.
Mm.
I ended up just liking Galway, the look of it. So I went there and it was great.
Yeah.
Because you did you did poetry, nonfiction, fiction, playwriting, script writing. And on the one hand, I could have never gone and I would still write, but I think it does give you functional skills about like applying to journals like The Singing Fly and knowing what to do with your writing more so. And I've just always wanted to write and I would do only that if I could afford to.
And tell me, so when you were there and you were studying all these various types of writing, was there one that you naturally gravitated towards?
Yeah, I had only written fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised that I liked nonfiction. I thought, wow, this is really cool. I was surprised that I liked poetry.
Yeah.
I thought I could do everything.
That you got the opportunity.
Yeah, and
to
I wouldn't have tried those things.
Yeah.
So, in third year, we got to specialize and just do creative writing, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And I picked poetry and nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And you were my teacher.
I was your teacher.
That
is the revelation of the podcast. We are not strangers.
Reveal. Big reveal. I was given a few, I was the only one who picked nonfiction.
You were the only one.
And so I was asked if I was really sure because I was the only one. And I thought, brilliant, because class to myself. Amazing. And then I was given a few essays to read and just see which one I liked. Mm. And I liked one of them. And Mike said, I'll see if she'll be your teacher. And it was you, which is amazing. I don't remember what the other essays were. Oh. I didn't know that's why the essays were given to me. But I remember it was the hump essay.
Yeah
that was great.
That's great.
Yeah.
No, you were a joy to teach.
Oh, thank you.
And tell me about, because from third year, even when I was working with you then, you know, your essays were very confident. You were very, you know, even when I was reading your new essay, you know, you're quite sure of your subject matter, I think. Do you feel that way when you're writing? Or do you have to find your way into the essay?
I don't. I definitely have to find my way in. I think in the few essays I've had published, it's never what I thought it was going to be at the start. Or maybe the first three pages are completely cut out and unnecessary. That is something I find quite amazing.
Mm.
And I find editor is quite amazing because I just think if I was just writing something and sending it and it was being published, it wouldn't be what it is. So yeah, I do think the editor plays an enormous role, which I was not aware of before I started having things published.
Yeah, and a great editor, you know, as they are at the Stinging Fly, can really, really improve things. Like just really tighten everything.
And sometimes I write because when I write something, I always think it's done. So then when you get a response from an editor and it's everything is, there's questions over everything and you just try not to cry for a second and you think, oh my gosh, I couldn't do this. Well, when you're feeling dramatic, you think, gosh, I'm not a writer at all. The editor is actually the writer and I am not coming up with any of this on my own. But that's just the flashes of non-confidence.
Exactly. And also, like, a very good editor, you know, they ask the right questions. Like you were even saying with this essay with Roisin and Lisa, that they, you know, they were finding out things, or you were finding out things. I think the best editor gets you to find, like, leads you there. It doesn't necessarily point it out, you know.
Yes. And the notes, I think, with Roisin and with Lisa are nearly always questions, which I think is so nice, because it's just something more to think about or something they want to hear more of. I struggle with knowing where to include the detail. I kind of gloss over a lot of things where an editor will come back and say, I want to know more about this. And I think, oh, okay. I didn't thought that was maybe boring or maybe non-essential. But I don't, the confidence thing, I don't feel so sure when I'm doing it. And I think that is something I'm trying to be less aware of, is I'm kind of thinking, where is this going? What's the point? Who's reading this? If it's a difference between making money going to work or writing something, I'm going to save my energy to go to work a lot of the time because that feels like instant approval from the world, and the way the world works. It's like this thing makes sense to do rather than sitting in a chair and typing. Yeah. But I'm trying to give myself more of that time.
Do you feel like, because obviously everyone experiences doubt, and I think all good writers experience doubt. Do you find it as it stops you, or, you know, you push through it?
It has, until I would say in the last few years.
Yeah.
I'm now pushing through more because you do realize everyone experiences this.
Yeah.
I can't think of any concrete examples now, but when you read writers who have written about writing, they all say this. Yeah. Everyone's struggling. Nobody likes what they've written.
No. Say nobody likes what they do. I was like,
nobody likes what they've written. Everyone's embarrassed of it by the time it hits readers. And so you just have to go against all your instincts and
I think there is
just try and enjoy it.
I think there is something probably wrong. And not in any of my own experiences. If you read something and you're like, this is amazing, you know, like maybe you have a burst of this is amazing. And then you
do
put
have
it away
a burst and then you read it and think, oh, that's so embarrassing.
Yeah.
But it's not embarrassing.
Yeah.
And other people will enjoy it.
Mm. Something I've always loved about your work from when you were young up to now is that your ability to bring in kind of disparate elements. So this essay is about the climate crisis, obviously, and living through that. But it's also about, you know, working and relationships. And can you talk about that a little bit? How you weave all of those things in? I think that's what a very good essayist can do.
Thank you. I think I will just, I've noticed with nonfiction, I will always go to those things. I will always talk about relationships and I will regularly talk about my dad and I will talk about work because those are just the three things
I think
my life has revolved around for the last like decade or more.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of unintentional, but as long as I don't repeat myself, I think it works. And then I kind of just try to focus or have an editor remind me to focus on the topic in question. But I do think I enjoy reading nonfiction of just people's normal lives a lot. I really like relating to people and that's why I read.
Yeah.
Because I feel like in the day-to-day world, you can feel like you don't relate to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of reading, I can relate to things. I can always, especially with how something's worded or phrased, I can really relate to everyone if I'm reading something. And I think that's what I'm also hoping for.
Yeah.
Not trying to do, but I'm just writing my days and like the world that I have been in as best I can.
Yeah.
Because that's what I enjoy reading the most.
You always should write what you enjoy reading.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
You write wonderfully about work, about being a waitress. Can you talk about that a little?
It's funny because I always say I'm working so that I can write, and then I never have time because I'm so mentally drained from being nice to people every day.
I want to talk about being nice to me. It does.
Well, I do have to amp it up a bit.
I loved when you worked in Arbia. That was the best.
Yeah, I've got quite a successful rate of serving Nicole in restaurants across the country unintentionally. The first Singing Fly I was published in was the Galway issue, yeah. And I found out because you came to order pizza at the restaurant I was working.
I was like,
and Nicole said, "Oh, you're in the issue." Brilliant. But yeah, I write it because it's just what I've spent the last 10 years doing.
Yeah.
So it's unintentionally been, it's pretty great because I've been complaining that I haven't had time to write and I'm not going to be a serious writer. And then all of a sudden I just realize I can write about this.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant.
I think the concept of the serious writer is very
challenging. I think that might come from, not that it was ever said at university, but maybe it was a self-imposed thing from studying writing. You kind of think, okay, this is a career path. Mm-hmm. You kind of think all these wrong things that can freeze you up a lot. I think I was frozen a lot thinking how I would be a proper... It's the same way you think about being an adult.
Yes.
Like, how will I...
I had so many visions of what it was going to be like.
And you find out it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
You can buy your own stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say cigarettes. That's why
you can.
I paused.
You can.
Yeah.
You can. But you... So you obviously, you know, you're on your feet, like you're on your feet, you're serving people, you're like being nice to people. Mm-hmm. There is that level of like, and like, you know, you've worked in, I think you were telling me before, you worked in like fancy restaurants in like Amsterdam and things. How does that feed into your work? Because that's sort of like a, you know, it's a little bit of a performance.
It is. Yeah. I've realized I could be a serious actor instead if this serious writer thing doesn't go well.
Yeah.
I think I see... how people, I feel like a bit of a psychologist, maybe. I kind of believe myself to know what people want, or that I interact with different people differently because I can kind of judge.
Yeah.
I am judging people.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on past experience or based on what the restaurant is. It does feel like a kind of superpower.
Yeah.
Social power that I don't feel I naturally possess when I'm not working. It just comes on, and it allows me to kind of be more instantly close to people than I am in normal life, which kind of allows me to understand a lot of different people in a lot of different ways, which helps with writing because I talk to people I would not talk to or be friends with normally. And I build these like really nice relationships with them for 5 minutes or for an hour or for 2 hours.
Do you think it has made you better at reading people?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. And then you can kind of use those people as characters if you want to. Or
I find like a fancy restaurant, particularly like a fascinating, because people go in there with like such a high expectation of what they want. Like sometimes it can be like quite like demanding or.
Yeah, it can be bizarre. I definitely prefer non-fancy restaurants. Just for the people, I've had people complain that they even have to talk to me because they would like everything to be done, you know, wordlessly, like this kind of show.
Yeah,
and that's not the kind of, that's verging on a kind of service that I don't want to provide for people. And that is your job that you're signing up for if you work somewhere like that. So, but I like being a waiter because you can wait anywhere.
Yeah. You can, and you've traveled so much.
That's the best part. You can't wait in Naples, I found out, without speaking the language, but you can go everywhere. It's kind of a movable
set of skills.
Career. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. And tell me about your Substack.
That is something I started because I was trying to write more. And I haven't been regularly writing since university, I would say. And I finished a horrible job that I won't talk about. And I was kind of having a bit of an emotional breakdown / outpouring after I'd kind of gotten through that and gotten out of it and was fine. I kind of allowed myself to feel all the feelings that I had suppressed just trying to get through the job while it was happening. And I started that Substack in one of those kind of this like blank state of not thinking about anything. And being vaguely aware that as I wrote something quick about how I was going to do this every Monday, it was kind of like a non-me outside of myself forcing the real me when she came back to just commit to this thing.
Yeah.
And no one's going to hold me to it. No, the 8 regular readers are not going to complain when I don't do it on a Monday.
I'd be like, where is she?
But I think it's good to hold myself to it. And I haven't missed a Monday. I think I started in September and I haven't missed a Monday.
And do you think it has like given you ideas or like freed up like your creativity in other ways? I don't have a Substack.
It rids me of the feeling that I need something to be perfect or that it needs to be going somewhere, which was stopping me writing anything.
Okay.
Because I thought if it's not getting published, there's no point. Or if it's not immaculate literary nonfiction, or that there was no point. Whereas these are not literary fiction. They're not edited. They're not. I just write something once and I'll either post it straight away if I don't have time, or maybe I'll read back over it.
Yeah.
But it's just a nice little outpouring.
Yeah,
while I wait to be discovered.
For acting or writing? Which one?
Either. Whichever, whoever comes first. Yeah.
And you also write short stories, very brilliant short stories.
Thank you.
Can you tell me just like the difference in feeling between how do you know something's going to be an essay? How do you know it's going to be a story?
The stories, now it hasn't happened often, but I do think stories just kind of appear sometimes.
Mm.
I do write ones that don't appear and I don't like them. But a few have just kind of arrived in my head.
I know exactly what you mean, and I know a story is going to be bad if I feel like I'm laboring on it.
And I do think but that's kind of, I know. Mm. I think the one that was in the last Stinging Fly was a good one that just appeared in my head.
Yeah.
But I love writing short stories because I don't know why. They just appear. They're nice. I love reading them. Mm. I don't think I was aware of them until college. I do think they're a great form for the world we live in because people have shorter attention spans.
Certainly do.
And also, it's just nice to have a bit of variety. You have a whole book with 10 stories in it. It's great. And I don't know if I could ever write a long thing. Mm. I'll try.
Yeah. Would you ever write a long thing?
I'd love to try. I will try.
Yeah.
But the short stories are the most that's ever come out of me so far.
And what are your stories about?
Also work. Also work. I think we were told in college that, I mean, I just feel like all my characters are me.
Yeah.
In some
you can't
way
say
another.
That though, Ella.
Well, I just did. So don't read my short stories.
You gotta lie through that one.
So they're all about work and they're all about working people. And even if I feel like it's a different scenario, like, oh, maybe it's a man and not a 28-year-old girl, it's still me. Yeah. with frills on and stuff. I just am, until I do something else that takes up most of my time, I might write about that. But at the moment, the work things just come naturally.
Yeah.
People at work, I like watching people at work also.
Yeah. I'm outside by work.
Because I don't like working. Mm. I would rather not work. Mm. I'm not someone that needs to work.
Yeah.
But everyone has to work. So I like watching people do it. And I feel accomplished when I do it too.
Yeah. And like, I love hearing about, I guess the interesting thing is like we were just talking about the difference between a person at work and at home.
Unfortunately, we're kind of our best selves at work.
Yeah.
Because you have to give most of your time and energy to it.
Yeah. Like even your parents, like if you ever, like my dad was a teacher, and if I went to school with him, I'd be like, he's like a different person at work, you know?
And my dad was an undertaker. And he was a taxi driver And then I think when they got the logo, when they had to get the logos on the side of their cars, yeah, he switched because the car would always get broken into and he didn't want like an ad for the taxi on the side. So he switched to being an undertaker. And I only, he did it for like 10 years. Mm. And I just assume when you're a child, you just think your parents like going to work. Yeah. And I think only once I asked, did he, I was like, do you like the job? He was like, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so shocked because I was like, you do it every day. Yeah. You do it 6 days a week sometimes. You do it the day after Christmas. Like it's, that was insane to me. I just assumed you assume they're doing these things by choice because they enjoy
they love it. Yeah.
So that I think is also where I get the work appreciation from. It's from my parents. My mom works in a toy shop as well, like an arts and craft shop.
Oh, that's
fun. And has done my whole life.
Yeah. Does she like her work?
I think same thing.
Yeah.
I think she's good at it, but is it what you want to do every day? No.
It's funny, like I don't think I realized until I was like a teenager, like maybe even a late teenager, that my parents probably didn't really enjoy their jobs, you know.
Yeah, I did.
In some ways or in other ways they did, you know.
Yeah, but they enjoy it because they're silver lining and they don't want their days to be wasted, maybe. Mm.
They never really complained though.
No, my parents never complained.
Yeah. Not millennials.
Yes, no. Yeah.
I never stopped complaining. You wrote one of my, I don't know if you've published this essay, but you sent it to me, this really great essay, I loved it, about Marge Simpson. Have you published this?
No, I'm trying.
Okay, can you talk about it a little
bit? Call?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was about relationships. I was living in Amsterdam. I had just gotten broken up with. And I was watching Simpsons. I watched so much Simpsons.
Yeah.
Hadn't watched it in maybe like 15 years,
I
watched it and it was so good.
Yeah,
it
holds up so well.
I was also emotionally at minus 10, but I was sobbing because of the plot line, obviously because of my own life, laughing out loud, like almost shouting at the TV. It was so good. And I couldn't believe what a piece of trash that Homer was that I had never noticed as a kid. And he didn't remind me of he reminded me of someone else.
Mm.
And like a relationship gone by. And I was like, that's what I was writing about Homer as this absolutely useless, horrific husband father, like useless.
Mm.
And how I hadn't noticed.
Mm.
And maybe just as a symbol of all these other male figures that you don't notice that they're not dependable.
Yeah.
People. And this is what you grow up with.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is what you grow up thinking, like, haha, funny dad.
I know.
Horrific.
Yeah.
She spends the whole, she's just cleaning up after him.
I know.
Doesn't even get a thank you. Well, he's the driver of the plot.
Yeah. Like,
there is no plot without him.
But he also gets all the punchlines. I think that's the other, like, I loved The Simpsons and it's still great.
It was so good.
So good. But, you know, he gets all the jokes and Marge is just in the background.
Yeah, she's lame. She's annoying. She's boring. She's a headache.
Yeah.
And yeah, God love her. She gets no appreciation whatsoever. He's a giant baby. He reminded me of a lot of people I've seen or been around in my life. And I just wrote about that. So hopefully that gets published.
That's a great essay.
Yeah.
I really
I didn't know I sent that to you.
Oh, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And can you recommend another story or essay or poem in the new issue that you enjoyed?
Well, I loved Nandini's story about the tulips and the wedding, but I also love Mia's essay about the bikes, especially having just come back from Amsterdam.
Yeah.
I love a good relatable nonfiction. Mm. I can relate to any nonfiction.
Mm.
But I really admired the way she kind of weaves the facts in as well. That's something that I don't think I do. I feel like I'm a bit more introspective and romantic, whereas this was both personal, like highly personal, highly factual. The stats were there. It made me laugh.
Mm.
And it deals with that thing of, can the individual do anything at all? And I've always thought that the bike versus car argument is kind of like the gender issue. Like one just appears to be physically larger than the other, maybe, and that's it. But they're both on the road.
Yeah.
And like, is there any difference? No, just an attitude.
Mm.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And the way she writes is kind of how she speaks, or how I imagine there's a lot of Jesus and a few swear words in there too. And I just thought that was great. It felt like she was talking to me.
And tell me, Ella, what's next?
What's next in life?
Yeah.
I'm moving to New Zealand in a day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Big move. I'm going to be a waiter over there and I'm going to keep writing.
Yeah.
I think I won't be allowed to work as many hours. So I'm hoping to write even more.
I'm very excited.
Yeah.
And you'll see so much natural beauty.
Yes.
You know,
I'm going to walk and think and write my first novel.
Very excited. We'll have you back on the podcast when you come back.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much,
Thank
Ella.
Thank you for having me and coming in sick.
Oh. I'm going to die after this episode. You were my last guest.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Stinging Fly podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share it. Or if you're new to the podcast, please subscribe. You can support the work we do by taking out a subscription to the Stinging Fly magazine or by becoming a friend of the fly. Information, all our workshops, events, and publications can be found on stingingfly.org. The Stinging Fly podcast is hosted by me, Nicole Flattery, produced by Owen Rogers, and edited by Ian Mullaney. Thank you to the Arts Council, who provide funding for this podcast, and for everything else that the Stinging Fly is doing to seek out, nurture, publish, and promote the very best new writers and new writing. We'll be back next month. Thank you for listening.